Shorts theme song.
Nice shorts. Yeah.
Howdy, hey, and welcome to Nice Shorts.
I'm Fu Yang.
And I'm Johnny Niddle.
And this is a show where we interview animators about shorts they make.
Today, we have Cammy Kwan.
Cammy is a stop motion director, producer, and one of the partners at Apartment D Films, an animation studio in Burbank, California.
Over the next two episodes, we'll be talking to Cammy about making the American Girl doll short series.
And what it meant to Cammy to help tell the story of their first Asian American Girl of the Year doll.
She'll also tell us about the origins of Apartment D and how she has transitioned from animator to overseeing a full production crew.
And a bit about some of her amazing work animating a music video for The Life I Know by the band The Itchy Worms.
So come along and meet the amazing Cammy for yourself. You'll thank us later.
And now on with the show.
Cammy!
Hello!
So happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Please, as if we wouldn't.
Be anticipating for this moment. Yes.
It's always an excuse to get you on a Zoom again because it's so much fun. And are you going to sing and dance
metaphorically? Yes. I don't know if you want it's a swing dance, but solo is not so fun to watch. So metaphorically, I will sing and dance.
Can I tell people that during spotting sessions, you do sing like a lot of the stuff, and when you act out the parts, it's really musical and very fun.
Yeah, absolutely. For animation, for me, well, for everything, like music is very important. And I think of things in rhythm, especially when I'm animating, like even if it's not a musical section per se, like there's rhythm to it. There's visual rhythm. There's a rhythm of the motion. And so my directing is very like rhythmic. And like my animating is very rhythmic. It's very like he picks it up. Whoop, bop, bop. Ha ha ha. Like there's a lot of sounds, a lot of like motions for the podcast. I'm sorry, this is not going to be as rich.
But you filmed yourself on your phone and like put it on the table and send it to me. I'm like, that's so helpful. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime. Yeah, I'm Cammy, and I'm one of the owners of Apartment D, which is an independent studio, animation studio in Burbank, California. Yeah. We specialize in stop motion, but we do a little bit of everything. So strangely do a lot of pixel art. So like 8-bit, 16-bit, 32-bit, like video game emulation and stuff like that. We've done a handful of projects like that. We do 2D, we do some digital stuff, but our prime focus is stop motion. So right now in the studio, we have a couple small projects. We're working with Nickelodeon on one of their shows, Middlemost Post. We do some stop motion for them. And I'm personally working on some development right now. So we have a couple partners who are trying to develop a few projects for animation. So that's been really, really new and interesting for me, is kind of learning how to take things that weren't originally animated and rewrite them potentially for the animated screen. So that's been really interesting and really, really fun. But just before this, we were doing our third installment of the American Girl Girl of the Year series. So that's a stop motion animated series. It's about an hour long, 6 10-minute episodes or so. We've done one every year for the last 3 years. So this was the third one. Third time's a charm. We had like all the processes worked out by this point. So I think this one ran the smoothest that it's ever run. It was the most efficient that it's ever been. It was like the chillest and most fun it's ever been. And also the character this time meant so, so much to me. So I think it was the one that I felt the most kinship with, and it was very dear to my heart. So Corinne, who is the Girl of the Year for 2022, is Chinese American. And so she's Chinese American, and she's the first Chinese American main character that American Girl has ever made, and she's the first Chinese American Girl of the Year that they've ever made. And I really liked American Girl dolls when I was a kid, but there was never anyone who looked like me or represented anything that looked like me or my sister. So having this character come, and being allowed to direct for it was just so meaningful. It meant so much to me. And this character was the first one who had a younger sister who was part of the story and was like a main doll that they created. And I have a younger sister who I'm also very close with. And it was just, there are so many similarities between myself and Corinne. And it was, you know, it came at kind of a really pivotal moment for Asian Americans right now. Like, I think we're having a whole, you know, we're having to grapple with our identity in a way that we haven't had to or been allowed to before. And like, I was no exception for that. Like, I think I've been having a lot of realizations about, you know, about how that has affected my life in just as this project came about. And so it came at just the perfect time where I was kind of going through the same things that Corinne goes through in the story. And it was really meaningful. So for those of you who are not girls ages 4 to 10, Meet Corinne is a story about Corinne Tan, who is a 10-year-old girl living in Aspen, Colorado. And she's going through a lot of things that most kids go through. Like, her parents are divorced and her mom is remarried. And so Corinne and her sister Gwen are having to learn what it means to have a blended family. And Corinne has friendship troubles and, you know, normal stuff that applies to just everybody. But what was really unique about this story that sets it directly in the year 2022 and directly speaks to the Asian American experience is Corinne actually experiences like racism and bullying because of her race to do with the coronavirus. So it was really, really cool and like refreshing and inspiring and exhilarating and all the good adjectives to work on this project, because American Girl like did not shy away from any of the realities that kids today face. And I thought that that was so exciting. And like, those are things that I was kind of learning how to deal with too, like, you know, undoing a lot of like the incorrect notions that I had maybe had that like, oh, race doesn't matter because we're all equal. And then being like, well, actually, no, that's not true. Because, you know, you're raised being told that. But then, like, the older you get, the more you realize, like, the institutionalized, you know, inequities that are out there. But I think the model minority myth is, I don't necessarily, I don't mean to get too like deep here on the show.
No, it's fine.
But the model minority myth was one that like I had to really, really unlearn, because I think I grew up with like racism happens worse to other people. So it doesn't happen to me because nobody's like calling me names on the street or whatever. But then realizing like, no, that actually does happen to Asian Americans, like to a degree and a number that people just don't talk about. And like, yeah. So I don't know, coming to terms with like, no, I have experienced racism, but it just doesn't look the way that I was taught racism looks. And yeah, so I was dealing with a lot of heavy stuff, and this was really cathartic to be able to like work on a project that was, you know, lightly dealing with like lighter versions, because it is for children, but like kids are encountering that and they know what's going on, like whether we want to, you know, tell them or not, like they understand it and they experience it. So
highly recommend, like, not only for kids to watch the show, I think even like for me, it's still like called me when I see all the topics. It's very, I feel it's very real when watching this show. Like, all the topic are on the point, just like you said. It's very matched to the reality. And also, just, I don't know what to say now. Like, just go watch the show after you listen to this podcast, really.
Yeah, I think it deals with like what it actually looks like for a 10-year-old girl to be like faced with her first instance of racism directed at her. Because I think oftentimes you can see like really idealized situations where somebody says something mean and then you know exactly what to say and you stop it right there. But like, that's not how it happens for 10-year-old children. Through like myself, I'm 29 and I'm still like completely flabbergasted and like frozen whenever something like that happens in my life. And so showing like the reality of like, you don't always know what to say. And sometimes you don't say something in the moment because you're too scared or too like startled. And I think like actually modeling that this will happen and that's okay, but you can work past it and like learn what to say and learn how to react. It is like you said, Fu, like it's pretty realistic.
I remember when you shared the scripts and I was like, yeah, they just went all in.
They really did. Yeah, they didn't shy away. Corinne's stepfather is, I think he's Danish-American, Swedish-American. Hmm. I think he's Swedish-American. But yeah, so Arnie, Corinne tells him that a boy was being racist to her. But then Arnie says it was probably just a misunderstanding. He probably didn't actually mean that. Yeah, and I don't know. It's having a script that's like, it's just so true. Like that definitely would happen. But then it's cool because to see later in the script, Arnie apologizes to Corinne and owns up to the fact that like he was wrong to not listen to her and that he believes her and he's so sorry that he dismissed her experience. Like to show an adult man like apologizing to his 10-year-old stepdaughter, it's just so powerful. And like as a kid to see that like your experience is valid enough that it like outweighs whatever an adult thinks. Like,
yeah,
I want every kid to know that their experience is just as valid as whatever any adult could say to them.
What was the thing you told me about one time? Big mood or big emotion?
Oh, big feelings. Yeah. Feelings, how to deal with big feelings.
Yeah.
And yeah, this generation, oh, it's so great to be like working in kids media these days because it's come so far from anywhere that it was previously, you know, where like shows actually work with like emotional intelligence and teaching kids like concepts about like having big emotions and how to deal with those big emotions and that those big emotions are okay. And, you know, things that I think when I was growing up, we were told like, never yell, like never hit, being angry, like you weren't allowed to be mad at people. Mm. But I think these days the messaging is so different. It's like, yes, you can be mad and it's okay to be mad. And sometimes it's good to feel mad, but like you have to learn, I don't know, you just have to teach kids how to feel it and then what to do with those emotions rather than just saying, don't feel that. So it's cool to be part of that wave of media that's actually like acknowledging these things and modeling how to deal with them.
Yeah. Don't ignore it. Just speak it out if you need to. Yeah. It's a healing process too, right? Even the adults, when they point out everything they say to you, which is, it's showing they understand you, that is super healing inside.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Envious of kids who are growing up today. I think they're going to come out so much better equipped than we did. They're doing all the learning now that we're having to do in our like 20s, our teens and stuff.
For people who don't know, the American Girl dolls, you are animating with the doll. So there's a lot of technical challenges in there, right? One, the faces are set. You're not moving the mouse. You are rigging the doll as is at the sides as is. So your stages are also massive.
Oh, yeah.
So I would love to hear about just one from the beginning of like you have a script dealing with such delicate emotions.
Oh, yeah.
And then having to direct that, then force that motion, then for the ones with less movements and then all of that. Because that's, Cammy, you're a god. Like, that's amazing.
It's not me. It's truly, it is a team effort. So yeah, that's a really good question because like you see the American Girl dolls, if you've ever held an American Girl doll, it's like, they're like 18 inches big. They've got the eyes that like they close when they lay down and they open when they sit up. And that can be a little bit unnerving. And they don't have any elbows or any knees or ankles or anything. Mm. And so, yeah, you're right. One of the biggest challenges with any toy animation, but with American Girl specifically, is how to get the like really nuanced, big, complex emotions across on these like relatively stiff dolls. So the first thing is like we are not animating them as they come out of the box. We have a whole puppet department, and what they do is they basically have to build skeletons and we put those back inside the dolls. So we have a body block, we build a block for the chest and a block for the hips. And so that adds like a grip point for the animators to grab on, because otherwise it's just like stuffing and that's not going to stay put for stop motion. Yeah. In those body blocks, we have rig points. So we have rig points in the like hip area and a rig point in the chest area. And those are where we can open up the clothing and just put right in there, the rigging to get them to jump or run or do all the action packed stuff. Skiing. Yeah. The skiing and the ice skating were so fun for this one. Our very first American Girl series that we did was surfing, and we were just kind of, we had to just sit for like a day or two and be like, how are we going to make surfing happen? What the heck?
Is that something you learned a lot going in from previous animations?
For the wave specifically, no, we like made that completely wholesale. So for what Johnny's talking about is, so Meet Joss was the very first American Girl series that we directed. It was the first, like, it was the first massive thing that I directed. Everything else before that was like 10 minutes max. But then it was 60 minutes. But for that, there's both ocean waves like lapping on the shore, and then there's the big wave like out in the ocean. So for both of those, we had to kind of make that up from scratch, because we didn't have like an extensive VFX budget where we could CG things in. A lot of what we really try and do at Apartment D is we make the limitation into an advantage. And so we lean really into the like craftier style. Don't shy away from showing the textures of stop motion. So for the big surf wave, we actually got blue shower curtains that had like a water texture on them and glued them together. So we had a sheet that was like, I don't know, I want to say like 16 feet long, maybe 18 feet long. And then we had just like two bars, one tall bar, one low bar. And we just draped the shower curtains over the bars, put a little bit of like weight at the base of the wave to give it that curve. And then we just like pulled the shower curtain along those two bars and just filmed it frame by frame. And we had a second shower curtain sheet that went over the top of the top bar, and we glued stuffing onto the edge of it. And that was like the foam at the head of the wave. And it's so low tech, but it looks awesome. And getting the waves lapping on the shore, we just had, and this was kind of a beast to animate. So Christine Brennan and Keanu Morales were two of our animators who did these waves for us, and Willie Fair. But the waves on the shore, we just had two giant sheets of plexiglass, and it was textured plexiglass. And the top sheet had the shower curtain underneath, so it looked like glassy water and it had the water texture. And the bottom sheet was just clear with a little bit of like texture in it. And we just had like yards and yards of foam stuffing. And we devised a little like mechanism where we could push both of the waves up together. And then like we would pull one back and then pull the other back. So it's like it would come up as one thing, but then kind of get that effect of like sliding back.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it looks so good. It's honestly, those are some of my favorite things we've ever done.
It really does look cool.
Thank you. But yeah, so it's all just like, it's all really, I'm going to say low craft, because the materials and the mechanisms are very simple, but just because it's simple doesn't make it easy and doesn't make it any less like technically impressive. But you can just, if you look at it, you're like, that's shower curtain and that's plexiglass and that's stuffing. But that's the magic of stop motion, I think, is like, I love being able to tell what something's made of. I think you should be able to tell what it's made of. Like when you can't tell that it's stop motion, like, you might as well just do CG. Like, don't try and imitate a computer. Like, let it be what it is.
Yeah, you use motion, how it moves, to define that those found objects. So
exactly.
Yeah. That's great.
That's why animation. Like, you don't. It doesn't have to be what it is. Like, it is what it moves like.
Yeah.
There's some phrase in there.
It's like sound effects, like not the literal sound, something that would sound like it doesn't, and then something else that doesn't sound like it does. You're like, oh, that's the right sound.
Yeah. You have to do like what you think it should be, not like what it is.
Right.
Anyway, but back to the American Girl dolls, getting them to have those very, very complex and nuanced acting. So the armatures are where we have to start. So it's got body blocks, and then they've got wires that go to their limbs. So you have like really precise control of like where those limbs are going. Yeah, it's a little uncanny and a little unnerving to go into a puppet department like in full swing, because there's just like doll heads lined up, because we have to take their heads off so we don't mess up their hair too bad. And like, yeah, it's a little crazy in there sometimes. But yeah, so the armature is kind of where it all starts, because that's what's going to give the animators the control over those dolls. And then honestly, from there, you know, we've worked really hard to make a style that fits the American Girl dolls and the American Girl storytelling. So we really focus on going pretty poppy, like pose to pose animation. It's a lot closer to like regular cartoons than it is to something like Laika or like, you know, really lifelike animation, because mm-hmm. that's how you get into the uncanny valley, because these dolls are already like somewhat lifelike. And yeah. so if they moved really naturally, it would look pretty creepy. So that's why we decided to stick with like a more cartoony poppy style. So it was like very much definitely a cartoon. Also, that pose to pose style, you don't need to have as much of those like elbow and knee articulations, as long as you have like really good, clean, big silhouettes for the mm-hmm. characters. And so that helps a lot. But then it's those big pops. But with American Girl, you need to have a lot of eases in and out of stuff. And that's what gives that like softness and lushness that you kind of crave, because if it was too poppy, it would be a little bit sharp. So yeah, for my perspective for directing is like, I want the animators to animate the way you would talk to who it is you're trying to communicate with. So with kids, you want to talk like very entertaining. You want to be like quick and to the point and full of action and fun, but you're also gentle and you're not like slamming into them with information. You're like presenting things simply and exciting, but with like gentleness. And I think the animation style yeah. is just another way of communicating. And so we want the style to match the communication we're trying to achieve.
Because they're so large, is it easy to underdo the movements?
I would say probably, yeah. I think you can be intimidated by how far in space you're moving that puppet, you know, to get the same effect. Because normally stop motion puppets are like 8 to 10 inches tall. Like that's a pretty ideal size. These guys are almost double that. And so, you know, if you're animating a normal puppet, a big move is moving an arm 2 inches, but a big move with an American Girl is moving it 6 inches, 8 inches. Mm. And that can feel kind of crazy when you're doing it at first. we're really fortunate. So Sean Maloney is one of the partners at Apartment D. It's me, Sean, and Max Lopez are the three partners. And Sean is an incredibly gifted animator, and he worked at Stupid Buddies for forever. And that's where he developed like his style, which is naturally very poppy and very like snap. Like if you frame through his work, he's taking increments that seem impossible. You're like, how could you move the character from here all the way across the screen? Like, that shouldn't be possible. But if you just watch it back, it feels totally fine. And yeah. a lot of that has to do with the easing in and the easing out. Like, you can get away with murder if you just ease out enough. Sean, in the very first American Girl, spent a lot of time, he and Christine and Keanu all spent a lot of time practicing poses for the dolls to see what looked good, and practicing moving them just to see like what increments you could get away with and like what could feel good. And I think with a lot of animators, when they first start on American Girl, they tend to go towards that more naturalistic way with like not very poppy movements and like much smaller increments and stuff like that. But under Sean's guidance as an animation director, he was able to guide a lot of our initial animators towards the current American Girl style. So like as a team, we all kind of developed that style, and we've now done it enough that we have like a whole animation Bible that we can just pass along to the next generation or the next crew, and they're able to follow that to really emulate wow. the style well. And we were lucky enough on our second American Girl, which was Meet Kira, and on Meet Corinne, we had the exact same animation team on both of them. So that's partially why Corinne was so good, is because all those people had done American Girls before.
For the very first series, so when you guys came in and you had the dolls, how did you do the armatures after that? Was that a lot of experimentation? Just what did you do?
It was experimentation. So we were working with a woman named Nikki. Nikki is an experienced stop motion armaturist. And we knew this was going to be wire armatures, like definitely wire. And I think she made a test puppet for us, and then Sean animated it. And the biggest thing for us was checking the tension of the wires to see like what wire recipe we wanted, like how many of what kind of wire. Because we knew, because they need to be soft enough that we can get like really small increments, but they need to be tough enough that it's going to hold up for 12 weeks of animation. For Joss, I think we did like, I don't even know how many weeks of animation. We learned a lot on that first project. I think we worked probably 7 days a week for maybe 3 months. We worked through Christmas break. Like we worked through New Year's. Like we had not learned how to production manage as well at that point. We're much better now. but yeah, so for the American Girl dolls, like their shape was already pretty dictated because this is the doll and this is what they have to be. But there is experimentation to be done. Like their limbs are hollow vinyl. So it's like, do we need to fill those limbs to give it the rigidity so they can stand up? But then that makes it really heavy. So like, do we only need to fill their ankles? Like, do we only need to fill this part of them? And so there was experimentation. And I think every season we improve how we go about doing it. Just we're lucky to work with people who are able to make those improvements and like innovate things for us every year.
Are they all like scored and sliced up for easier bending?
No, because the arms themselves, like we can't really change them that much in case you see them. So no, we don't bend the elbows and we don't bend the knees. Mm. We leave them exactly as they are. They only bend where the actual dolls can bend.
Yeah, a tiny thing as an audience that I was thinking that how about the hair?
Oh my gosh.
How about the eyelid? How do you slightly change it?
The eyelids are, the American Girl eyes are like such a very special, specific thing. Just getting them to blink, you just stick glue dots under the eyelashes and slap them down and then you pull them out when you're ready for them to open again. It's so easy. But our animators are so awesome and so genius that they've realized over, you know, the last 3 years that you can get the American Girls to do tiny little eye shifts to make it look like their eyes are shimmering and filled with tears. And you just take like a tiny little thing and like tap the eye to one side and it'll shift to one side just slightly. And then you just tap it back. And like, we have a little algorithm for just like what you have to do to make the eyes shimmer, to make it look like they're crying, but you don't have to put anything into the eyes. It's just tapping them back and forth in their little sockets. And making them blink, you just like glue them down and you pull them back up when you're ready. For one of the characters in this series though, Gwyn is a slightly different type of doll. She's like a Welly Wisher, which is an American Girl doll for younger girls. Mm. So they're smaller, they're a little less expensive. So you can give it to your younger child without being like, this is an heirloom. It's like a little bit more low key. But Welly Wishers don't have eyelids. And so we had to talk to American Girl and be like, can we make eyelids for this doll? And they had to like go back and talk about it internally, because normally toy companies don't want you to alter the toys because they don't want kids to see the toys doing something and then think that they can do that and then be disappointed when they can't. Mm. And so that was like a whole like 2 days of discussion about whether we could build eyelids for Gwyn. Ultimately, they said we could because they wanted to prioritize her acting over the... over being exactly true to product, which I'm really grateful for. And then hair. American girls have really nice hair. Yeah. It comes and they're like, it's really soft and shiny and beautiful. And then we immediately fill it with hairspray and it's like crunchy and like rock hard.
Hairspray, okay.
Yeah, we use a lot of different hairsprays or hair gels, hair mousses. Our different heads of puppets all have different ways of going about it. For, I think, this most recent season, our head of puppets, Joe, found this like waxy spray. And so it was like slightly more malleable than the normal hairspray that we use. It was slightly more malleable. So it didn't look as crunchy and it didn't like, get as nasty.
Dandruff stuff?
Yeah, it didn't get dandruffy, but it held really well. And so that was a big innovation. But the girl's hair, like we need to make sure it stays really nice during animation. Like sometimes if the hair gets too crazy, we have to reshoot the whole shot if the hair gets too gnarly, because it's really important for client that the hair looks nice in every shot. And like, God, I can't even tell you how many times I've very apologetically handed a shot to our post team and been like, I'm so sorry. Can you fix this? And usually they can. They're fantastic. We work with Dynamic Fox Films, who are some friends of ours from Rochester, New York, which is where we all went to school. And they've worked absolute magic on every series, on this one especially. So many of the backgrounds in this series actually like did not exist. Anytime you see skiing, like that set doesn't exist. They built all of that, which is incredible.
Wow.
Yeah. It's so good. It was beyond my wildest dreams what they accomplished on this series. Like, they're true miracle workers. And that's something that we've been working really hard to develop at Apartment D is, like, you know, when you think about bringing stop motion into the future, like, a lot of people tend to think about, like, oh, 3D printing and, like, robots doing more stuff and, like, make more things CG. But for us, bringing stop motion, like, into the future can be a lot more simple. And what that kind of looks like is, like, learning how to build our environments from stop motion pieces, but then compositing them in After Effects and stuff like that. It adds a lot more flexibility, especially if you're working with a commercial client. Oftentimes they are used to being able to change things up until the very last minute, especially if they're used to working with 2D or CG. So breaking a lot of your stuff into elements will give you a lot more flexibility, and it makes stop motion more competitive with 2D and CG because we can offer more flexibility.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that one of the harder selling points in general, is that rigidity after a bit in the process?
I would say yes, but nobody knows enough about stop motion to even know that that's a problem when they first go into it. So often we find that with a new client or somebody we haven't worked with before, we're having to kind of educate them about how stop motion works. And so we have to be, like, very, very clear. We have a whole packet of, like, these are the things you need to know about stop motion. After this date, we cannot change how the puppet looks because we are going to physically build it, and then it is done.
Speaking of physical building, would you like to talk about the stages for this thing?
Oh my gosh. I love the stages for this thing. I think we've had, like, a 16 by 12 stage. That's in some of our big ones.
Huge.
They're very big. Yeah, so the puppets are 18 inches. And so everything else, you know, has to be just as large to accommodate all of that. So a small stage for us is a 2x4. Like, that's pretty small. That's the smallest you'll go. Our large stages, are like 16 by 12. We had a lot of outdoor sets in this one. And in our previous series, we had a lot of outdoor sets. It was set in Australia, but we learned a lot from doing that series. And so for this series, we ended up being able to accomplish a lot more depth than we were in the previous one. And that's just us learning, you know?
What was the challenge from the previous one? Like, what was it that you ran into the wall on? I guess, pun not intended.
It was the wall. It's just the walls. They're a problem. We tend to do, like, a really graphic style normally, but for something like American Girl, which is relatively realistic, you need to get a lot of that sense of depth, especially if you're going to be set in, like, the Colorado mountains. So learning how to properly scale things to force perspective was something that we, with all of the knowledge from our previous series, we were able to, like, properly force that perspective now. I think we probably cleaned out the, like, local model railway house of all of their miniature trees. So you had trees from, like, 2 inches tall or like 1 inch tall to 2 inches tall to 5 inches tall to, like, giant trees that were bigger than the American Girls, and just, like, setting those up strategically. A big step forward that we took was getting Bridal Veil to make a layer of atmosphere. So if you look, so our set, it would be our big set stage. And then there would be a line of hills with, like, smaller trees. And then we had two mountains. And then after those mountains, or maybe right in front of those mountains, there would be a giant sheet of, like, I think it was like 16 by 16 or like 20 by 16 Bridal Veil. And it's like this very, very sheer kind of, like, fine tulle. And you wouldn't notice it if you're just looking at it, but it adds just a fine layer of atmosphere between the foreground and the mountains in the background that made the world of difference.
That's so, so cool. Yeah. Directly use the material to do the atmosphere. Wow. I didn't hear about that before. This so cool.
they did a lot of that on Tumbleleaf, which is the show that I worked on before I went to Apartment D. And so they would do, like, 1-2 layers of Bridal Veil to get atmosphere. And I've seen DPs who can take lights and create sunbeams by angling the lights onto the bridal veil. They'll actually get like beams of light, and it's so beautiful. We did not need to go that far on this one. So Warren, who's our director of photography, was spared for the time being, but we own bridal veil now and I'm going to be using it. So we'll see. Warren can do anything though, so I'm not worried. Yeah, that's I'm like a sucker for cool lighting. So like anytime I can get Christmas lights or stars or lanterns or a sunset, like I'm all about that. So.
So there are large trees, big doll, big stage, and the animators have to get in there without messing anything up.
Oh yeah.
So the question is how?
How do they? Oh, carefully. What one part of it is carefully, like part of the job of a stop motion animator is to like kind of, you know, train yourself to be careful and be delicate and like be able to like get into a scene without dislodging everything. But there's like a limit to what is reasonable to ask somebody to avoid. And so we really, at Apartment D and just like as people in general, we work really hard to make sure that like that everything is a team effort. So with access to a stage, the animators have to be able to like be pretty flexible, both like emotionally and physically, with getting into the stage. Sets has to work hard to make sure that when they set up the set, they're setting it up with access for the animator in mind, and they're locking things down, like things that the animator might bump. Sets has to be really mindful to lock all that stuff for them. Post has to be really flexible with being like, yeah, we're okay. If you guys take a good clean plate, like we can deal with chatter over here. And then camera and lighting has to be really thoughtful with how they set up the camera and how they set up the lighting to make sure that there's room for the animator. And then I, as a director, have to be thoughtful to be like, okay, maybe we don't need to have the camera right up against the doll's face because now the animator can't reach. Warren, DP, can we get like a tighter lens so we can move the camera back? And like, it kind of sounds like a lot when I say it out loud, but like every single part of the machine is all working together to make things as easy for everybody else as possible. Yeah. And like, there's so much teamwork that has to happen to make that go.
Clean plate is like a still shot that can mask out stuff.
Oh yeah. 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 So we take head plates and tail plates. So you take a plate before you start animating just to like preserve what it looks like before you go. Mm-hmm. And then you animate and then you take all the dolls and the rigging out and you take a clean plate at the end. So in case something shifted, maybe the shift matches better with the end than it does with the beginning or something like that. But we've learned in blood that you need to get a clean plate for every shot from every angle. 'Cause we actually do a lot of our projects, we don't have time to shoot everything on set because sometimes there are sets that you use a lot. So with American Girl, they're always in their bedroom because their bedroom is where a lot of their product is. And it's like the bedroom is one of the places that's most relatable for young audiences. 'Cause for kids, like most kids have a bedroom, whether they share it or whether it's theirs, like all kids have a bedroom and a bedroom is really fingers crossed. But a bedroom is really special for kids because that's the one place that's theirs. Mm-hmm. And so the American Girl bedroom is like, it's like the most special place. It's got to be the prettiest. It's got to be the coziest. Like you got to make a place that kids can see themselves being. So a lot of the story is always set in the bedroom. We don't necessarily have the space or the time or the budget to build two different versions of the bedroom so that we can be shooting all of the minutes that we need on that stage. Mm-hmm. So we do something called front light, back light, which is where we take the dolls. Mm-hmm. And so we shoot them on a stage that has no set. And then later we comp them into photos of the set and we can make it look like they're in the set. Those clean plates are really important so that you have every angle of that set imaginable that you can have for that flexibility of putting those dolls back in the set later on.
Yeah, when you say the backlight, so what would that background look? Just simple, some kind of color?
So for our front light, back light stages, there are two options for getting a character element or any kind of element in stop motion for putting it onto a false background. There's green screen, which is pretty common, pretty well known. You have a green screen back here and you can like color pick that and be like, replace everything with this color. Because green screen works pretty well for live action because it's very large, because they're very large sets. But with stop motion, since our sets can be so small, our characters are much closer to those backgrounds than like a live action person would be. And so we get spill and reflection off of those onto the character, which can make compositing like kind of a nightmare. So what we do instead for our tighter, more intimate shots is front light, back light. So that is, we have our camera and lights set up to take two pictures for every frame. The first picture, the lights are on the character from the front and they're lit as if they were in a normal set. And then automatically the front lights turn off. And then the background, which is just a white card, the background lights up and the front lights go black. So you basically get a silhouette of the character and then you take that. And so now you have, for the same shot, you have two versions of the exact same shot. The character's in the same place at the same time for both of them, but one they're lit and one they're backlit. And so that you can use to key them out when you composite. And it is much quicker. It helps for really fiddly things like hair or fur, stuff that would be such a bummer in green screen. So we use front light, backlight a lot. That's, and it's so cool. Really efficient.
So you basically take a picture of a mask to get the reflection off for the green screen. That's so cool.
Yeah. My biggest weakness is lighting. Like, I could not light my way out of a paper bag. I'm terrible. But there's a lot of innovation that has to happen with it. Like for all of the skiing for this show was shot on a green screen, but the character had like in her ski suit, there was like a very prominent aqua in her ski suit, which was really close to the green screen color. And that just made it a gosh dang nightmare to green screen. So we actually ended up doing something with like a triple exposure. So we took the front light, which is with it lit normally. Then we took a backlight, and then we took a backlight with the green screen lit with orange lights so that we had an orange backlight that would, so it's like a, you know, so you could pick the orange and keep the blue in her suit, but take the orange out of the background, but then you could green screen for the other colors in her suit. Wow. Like, yeah, it was something that Warren and the Foxes innovated together. Yeah, it ended up looking so cool, but we didn't know we needed that until we started shooting against the green screen and the Foxes were like, hey, this is really hard to work with. It's going to take us 100 hours to do this shot. And we were like, okay, well, we can't keep doing this. So what can we do? So they and Warren and Sean worked hard together to figure out like a solution for that. And yeah, one of the things I think I'm proudest about our studio is like that we are able to be flexible enough to figure out those solutions and that we're open-minded enough, I guess, to hear those concerns and do something about them instead of just saying, well, work harder or like, well, try harder, you know, like,
yeah,
really take everybody's experience very seriously.
How long do you have for pre-production then production?
We turned this series around in about 6 months or so, I want to say. And huge props to American Girl. Like, they are wonderful to work with. Like, I will say it forever. I'll say it to anybody. Like, they're a great company to work with because they're really willing to learn along with us what it takes to make a production like this go well. So when we first started working with them for the very first series, they approached us in October and were like, hey, would you make this series? And we were like, okay. And then we started in November. And then the next year we started a little bit earlier. And then this year we started so much earlier. So for this project, we started talking to them about the character and about the world in like June or July. And that's when we started giving them feedback on the scripts, because one of the things that we all learned together is that it really helps for them to give us note passes on the scripts as they're being written. Not only to get our perspective, just like our creative perspective of like who we think the characters are and how we think they should act, but also to like add action sequences and kind of tailor the story to make it more visual.
Yeah.
And so that has been really awesome. But they came to us in like, I think June and July, maybe into August, we were doing all the script reviews. And then like August, September, we were doing all the like voice records, we were doing the set designs, we were doing there's not so much character designs, but there's like costuming is really important. So we were deciding all the costumes, we were doing all the storyboards, like all of that was kind of happening in the summer and the end of the summer. And then I think we started animating either late September or like very first thing October, and then we shot all the way through, we were animating all the way through to like mid-December. And then we took two whole weeks off for winter break, which is great. Yeah. We haven't always gotten that. Mm-hmm. And then I think maybe a week after animation started, post-production starts. So they're really like, as soon as it's finished on stage, we send it off to post-production so they get it as early as possible. And mm-hmm. I think that's maybe just shortly after animation started, Johnny was with us as the composer. Like, you were on pretty dang early.
I was I was composing to boards.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you definitely were there. And so then, yeah, animation finished mid-December. And then I think we were just finishing up post through January. And then it was over as fast as it had begun. But six months later and two more gray hairs. For an hour of content, I flatter myself we turned it around pretty quickly. To animate all of that in about 11 weeks is what it takes on stage to animate those, but that is just animation. That's not building, that's not puppets, that's not anything else.
Is there a common error people do when writing for stop motion?
For animation generally, a common error I see is people just doing talking head, just like scenes and scenes of people talking. And talking's fine, but like that doesn't look good on screen. Like, why would I watch people just sitting and talking? Like, if it's animated, make it necessarily animated. Like, let's do something with that. So that's normally the biggest problem that I see with a script that comes to us from anybody, is that there's not enough action in it. And so we're pretty fortunate that people come to us now to ask us to punch it up for action, which is great. Big problems for stop motion specifically is just like willy-nilly costume changes, or like willy-nilly adding another character in there. And I think for any animation, like, you can't, like, if you just add a third character into a scene and they don't have to be there, you're adding like 20 hours of extra work that like doesn't need to happen. So like get them out of there. So that's a big one. Adding locations for no reason. Like oftentimes in scripts, like after too much dialogue, it's like people going to one place one time for one episode out of the six episodes. And like, it takes us as much effort to make that one location for that one scene as it does to make us that one location that we'll use for 50 scenes. So a lot of the like creative massaging of a script that comes to us is like trying to consolidate the locations of where stuff takes place. And that's something that they're super willing to like, on American Girl, they've been really willing to work with us on those kinds of things, to be like, hey, can we have this set like in location A instead of in location B? Because location B actually is on screen for like 8 minutes in episode 3. So we can't really do any more there. And that's one of the first things we do when we get a script, is like we break it down. We have a whole like spreadsheet of like which character is in which location for how many minutes, for how many episodes. And so we can see like from the outset, like, hey, we're spending 30 of our 60 minutes in this location. Like, we need to break this up.
You had 9 stages, you said,
for this? Yes, 9 stages.
You were even helping build stages though, right? Like getting up, cutting lumber, and like doing all the stuff with everyone else?
Not so much. Okay. I think one of my pitfalls, one of the things I've had to grow out of as a director, is like wanting to do everything with everybody, because like in the end, I'm not serving anybody by like being mediocre at everything and then being too fried to be good at my job. So, but I will like, I do just like jump in if something's necessary. Like if we're shooting on a weekend, I'll just do sets and puppets. Like I'll paint this stage, like I'll do this puppet's hair. So I can fulfill like minor things for sets, like patching the set that they've already painted. So I'll do like minor stuff if everybody else is busy.
Yeah, you are being multiple role in no matter so many projects in Apartment D. You are willing to serve for people as a leader, but you serve for people and you are able to help with all kinds of like animating, fabricating, like because you have those experience and you have that heart to, you know, you really care about your teammates. Yeah. In the project. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I think that's what makes like a good That's what makes a production run well, I think, is if the people who are in charge of making decisions have done the things they're trying to produce, you know? I think one of the pitfalls of the stop motion industry often is like, we don't have enough people in charge who've done this art and who understand what it is they're setting people up for when they set budgets and set schedules. And I think that can end up hurting so many people in so many ways. You know, it causes like massive burnout when people are setting up unrealistic expectations, both for themselves and for the people working for them, you know? So one of the things we care a lot about is that our leadership has actual experience with what it is we're trying to lead. But yeah, I can talk about Apartment D right now.
Yeah.
Care to hear? Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So Apartment D is founded by Max and Sean in about early 2016, I think. They founded Apartment D. And then mid 2016 is when I moved to LA and kind of like met those guys. The reason I got my very first job out in LA was because of Max. I like cold emailed him because he's an alumni from my college. And I just like cold Facebook messaged him because he was working at Bix Pix, which was like the studio that I wanted to work at the time. And he gave me the email of the people that eventually hired me. So when I first moved out to LA, I definitely made sure to be like, Max Lopez, thank you so much. It's so nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. And my first 2 weeks at Bix Pix were Max's last 2 weeks at Bix Pix before he quit the studio system to focus on Apartment D full time. So he and Sean were in like a whole transition period. Shortly thereafter, so Max and I met and became good friends in those 2 weeks. And then shortly thereafter, they got a big project, their first like big project, a short for Nickelodeon. And for that, they wanted to do a downshot paper cut style. And coincidentally, I had been doing a music video in like a downshot paper cut style. So they asked me to come and help for a couple weeks.
Which was just released, by the way.
Yeah, it's coming out on Monday. This short, this music video that I made in 2016/2017 in my living room in my pajamas and it's finally being released on Monday, so people can see the first thing I ever made, for probably the first thing I ever directed outside of school, actually, which is crazy. It's called Truck Stop Shower for the band Smoothhound Smith, and one of the members of Smoothhound Smith, Caitlin, is actually my cousin, but you would never know it because she's got big blonde curly hair. And I'm half Asian, so, but she's actually my cousin, which is how I knew them. But yeah, so I made that music video, and then Max and Sean knew of that, and they were like, come help us on our project. And so I came and I helped them on that project, and I have never left since then. Because I think we all had like the same level of passion for wanting to make something great and being willing to do like everything we can to make it as good as it can be. And I think you don't always find like that in other people, you know? And if you find somebody who like matches your wavelength and like passes the vibe check, you know, it's really important to like stay with them or like stay close to them, those people that are driving you to like do better and be better and achieve more, like, and in a healthy, supportive way too. So that was my first project with them. And I think for the next like 2 years after that, I was still working full time on Tumbleleaf at Bix Pix. And they were working on and off at other studios around. But after about 2 years, Apartment D started taking off and being enough to take up all of our time. And Tumbleleaf was kind of ending as a show. And so that was just the perfect time for us to just decide, like, collectively, we're just doing Apartment D. Like, we're not doing studio work. We're not looking for studio work. Like, we're doing our own thing. So I took a handful of freelance things after that, a couple armature jobs for Bix, a little bit of animation for buddies, but only for a couple weeks at a time every time. And we've been full-time at Apartment D for like 3-4 years now, which is crazy. Yeah.
So just before the first American Girl?
Yeah, I think for the year preceding American Girl, we were full-time at Apartment D. We were doing a Hot Wheels series at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
which was really fun. We would go to part of some of them, we'd go to Mattel and shoot them there. And then some of them we would actually just shoot in our garage, which is where we did everything. Mm-hmm. I also did my second directorial project was doing like a little 10-minute series for a toy line called Enchantimals, which was really fun. They're like half human, half animal, like BFF magical girls. It was really fun. As a group, we directed, well, Max directed Polly Pocket, a Polly Pocket series for Mattel. And it was that Polly Pocket series that got us the Hot Wheels series, which got us Enchantimals, which got us American Girl.
Wow.
So okay. it all leads to the next thing. So yeah, for our most recent American Girl, we had 39 crew members. And not everybody was in-house. Some people were remote. Some people were only on for pre-production. Some people were just post-production. But all told, we had 37 people working on it. So going from the three of us and Warren in a garage, Warren, our DP, to 37 people making it, like, it is quite the growth in a couple years. So there's a learning curve that goes along to all of that. And sometimes it can be pretty painful, like going through those growth spurts. But it's also like the thing I think that I'm proudest of, maybe second only to the fact that like American Girl is putting like things out in the world that I think are really important for kids and important like media to make. But, you know, other than that, my proudest accomplishment is like having that large of a crew and like providing an environment that has been really healthy and like fun and caring and just like a good environment for people matters a lot to us. One of the most painful things about like going from just being an animator animating with your pals to being like, I'm a director and I'm directing this project and I'm in charge of this was realizing that I couldn't just be friends with everybody. That's just because like you take on certain responsibilities when you start leading people. And sometimes your job in like making the best project that you possibly can is telling people to like do their work again, or like to cut back and try it a different way, or to like remake that thing that I just watched you spend 3 days doing, but it's wrong and I'm sorry, but you have to redo it. You know, that was really, really painful to learn. But, you know, I think that's one of the biggest growth things is learning how to like have that emotional separation kind of. And that was really important for something like for the Corinne series. Like I knew going in that this was going to hit really close to home. And I knew going in that I needed to keep myself closed off a little bit emotionally from just this project, because in the end, like, this isn't my project. This is, I'm directing it. So learning to like keep some emotional distance from work and like work-life separation and all that stuff is really hard, because, you know, you get into animation because you love it. And that can make it really hard to separate yourself from what you're doing. So again, for something like American Girl, I felt really deeply passionate about that project. Like it was very personally connected to it. And so I knew that I needed, as much as I like wanted to give everything I had to this project, I needed to keep myself just a little bit emotionally separate, because in the end, like I'm directing it and I care so deeply about it, but it's not just my project I'm making for me. Like it's this project I'm making in partnership with someone else, and it's their project, not mine. And so I needed to find that balance between like giving all of my passion and all my care to make this project the best that I thought it could be, but also keeping myself distant enough in case what my, you know, production partner, American Girl, wanted was different from what I wanted. So I wasn't just like emotionally devastated if it was different from what I had in mind. And that like emotional separation is really important for between yourself and projects, and like between yourself and your friends when they're working for you, because sometimes your responsibility is not just to be somebody's friend. It's now your responsibility is to be their boss sometimes. And your responsibility is to make sure that this project is the best that it can be. And not just because, oh, I want it to be good because my name's attached to it. It's this project needs to be good so that we get more work so I can hire you again, and that we can all like have some stability and stuff. So there's just so much to think about and like so many different responsibilities. And like, I want to support my friends and be like, that thing that you made is so cool. And I'm so happy that you're making it. And I love that you love it, but I need you to redo it and not make it that way. I think there are a lot of instances where the first words out of my mouth after like, so if somebody comes to show me something, I'll give a prolonged silence and then go, I love it, but, and then be like, it has to be different for X, Y, and Z reason. And that was hard. I'm not good at confrontation. I am just like naturally very positive and encouraging and supportive. And I just want to tell everybody how wonderful everything they do is, but that's not conducive to like directing sometimes. So that was hard to learn.
It's so great and we can't use it, but it's amazing and no one will ever see it. So let's do it again.
Yes, exactly.
But then you also started the culture of like doing the parties of like the pumpkin patch and things and whatnot. So you're also building the relationships because of the studio while also separating the relationships. How do you balance that?
I think changing the way we think about like what we're doing and why we're doing it and going from, because I think, you know, when it was the three of us hotboxing a garage and working until 3 a.m. listening to metal, like you're doing it with your friends because they're your friends and you love doing this thing together. And, you know, partially, you know, planning social outings and stuff with the studio now, like everybody is my friend and I do just want to hang out with everybody, but I can't necessarily be everybody's just like personal friend because I'm still simultaneously their boss. And so thinking about making those events and creating that culture so they can have it, not so I can have it, not so I can have friends and and I can hang out with my friends, but so these people who I respect and trust and really, really like admire and enjoy, so they can have that culture and share it with each other, like whether I'm there to share it with them or not, like creating a space that you can be like really proud of and a space that you can like feel proud to bring people into. Yeah, I think that's one of the things that was the most important to us. And one of the reasons why we wanted to start a studio was to create that working environment for people in the stop motion industry, for our friends, for our like collaborators, for people we admired and people we believed in, and all that stuff was to make a good environment in the industry for them. When Max and Sean were thinking about starting Apartment D, when Max and Sean were starting Apartment D, and when I came on shortly after, we read so many business books. We read so many books to try and prepare ourselves to run a studio, because I think where a lot of people can maybe go a little bit awry is thinking that running a stop motion studio means that you are doing stop motion art all day long. But running a successful studio, like it's a business, it's a company, and you need to like learn those other underlying principles that will make it a sustainable place. Because like you can have the most fun, wackiest place to work ever, but if you don't get your next job, like it doesn't do anybody any good. So we read a ton of books about like business and about marketing and about like medieval political theory and stuff like that.
I saw that on your list. I'm like, Machiavelli, okay.
Yeah, our list of books, we have like a list of like necessary must reads. And so I can rattle those off for you now if you like to hear.
So a couple of them I never heard of. And like, oh, what's that?
Oh, they're all great. So the first one was Herding Tigers, and that's about like learning to manage creatives and like learning to create environments that are the most conducive to people being happy and fulfilled, but challenged and also have discipline and like all that stuff. So Herding Tigers was really good, knowing that we wanted to manage creative people. The Harvard Business Review of Marketing. I read that when we were starting to realize like, oh, we need to take social media seriously and like kind of market ourselves. I think I spent like 3 months, maybe 2 months, just learning about social media and just learning about marketing. And so that one was really helpful. And it's not always like, none of this is directly like, here's how to start an animation business, but it's like, you know, taking those lessons from other businesses and applying it to our situation. And even if it's not directly applicable, like a lot of those theories and stuff end up being really useful, just the concepts that they present.
Even business need creativity to do it, right?
Absolutely. Max will often compare like running a business or like running this studio to like having a big complex machine, and you just keep tweaking all the little things to get it to run right. Max is like by trade a machinist and an armaturist. So But so that's Harvard Business Review marketing. The business model canvas was so useful. It's actually, it's very, very heavily illustrated and very graphic, which was very helpful for me. but the business model canvas really helped break down like how you as a business fit into like the wider world of people who are going to pay you money to do the thing that you do. And so you learn like how to like communicate to people what it is you're offering to them and how to like position what it is you do to be the most valuable. Like, it's just kind of learning that wider world of like where you would fit in as somebody, as like a service provider or whatever. So that one was helpful. The Prince by Machiavelli is really helpful. Cause you know, when you start getting bigger and people are like maybe asking you to, you know, pay you a lot of money to make something, like there's some politics that are going to go down. So learning about that was good. And like, there's also a lot of stuff about like leadership in there. And, you know, granted, this is not like an early century Italy, like we're not running a principality, but like there's useful things in there, like deal all your cruelty at once, but like dispense your generosity over a long period
that's
of
so
time.
Cool.
you could ignore the sections about leaving your military behind so everything goes right. You could ignore those parts.
Yeah. Don't worry about salting your enemy's earth. Like that'll come later. but so that one's just helpful, especially for somebody like me who I'm like, no confrontation, be friends with everybody. If you're nice, good things will come to you. Like that's not always how business happens. Learning the realities of that. we try and run it as if that is how it is though. And it's got us pretty far. That one's good. The Prince, The Art of War by samurai philosopher Miyamoto Musashi is good. That one's just kind of more like prepping your mind and how to like appear empty but really be full, and that one's useful. And then the 4-hour work week and the E-Myth have been really helpful, especially as the studio grows. We're learning, there's a lot of stuff in there about like how to actually run a business in a sustainable way, and a lot of that is like delegation. You have to delegate at some point. You need to let go of being the one that does the making and be the person that's telling people how to do the making, and that's a hard pill to swallow.
It comes across as depressing to a lot of people when you realize I am a business and this is a thing. So how did that hit you?
I think it can still be depressing sometimes. Like some days I'll just be leaning with my head against a window and be like, I don't make anything anymore. I'm not even an artist. But, you know, those are just like the low periods, and the rest of the time it's fine. But no, in all seriousness, like that's something that we still grapple with like every single day, is trying to balance. Like we got into this because we're artists and we want to make art, and balancing like the day-to-day satisfaction of practicing your craft versus like the overall satisfaction of understanding like what we're moving towards and why we're moving towards it. So like the reason why we even started Apartment D instead of just staying animators for the rest of our lives was for that overarching goal of like, for me, it's I want to make media for kids that is educational and makes the world better and like, you know, influences how they're going to see the world and how they go about like interacting with the world. Like I want to be in a position where I can make the media that I think is valuable happen. And as an animator, there's a limit to what you can achieve and like what you can make happen in this industry, because as an animator, you can only animate the jobs that have been given to the studio that you're working for. But as a studio, you can go and make those jobs happen. You can convince somebody to make their project in stop motion instead of CG. You can convince somebody this book should be a series. You can make those jobs happen where they wouldn't have happened before. And so I think understanding that and like why I want to do that, that it will bring better media into the world, that it will help kids, that it will provide jobs, that it will strengthen this industry, that it will give us the resources to create an environment that can help people grow. Like all of those reasons are mean more to me than I have a lot of fun working with machines. So I think it's really keeping that like big picture in mind is how I can be okay and how all of us can like be okay letting go of like practicing our craft and like being artists in a day-to-day sense.
That's the end of part one. We'll be back soon with the rest.
Bye-bye.